I'm Ken Best, editor of UConn Magazine. David Yaloff is associate professor of political science in the College of Liberal Arts and Sciences at UConn. His book, Pursuit of Justices, Presidential Politics and the Selection of Supreme Court Nominees, won the 1999 Neustadt Prize for Best Book on the Presidency from the American Political Science Association. With the opening of Senate confirmation hearings on the nomination of Elena Kagan to serve on the Supreme Court of the United States, we discussed the nomination process with Professor Yaloff. We began the conversation by asking him to provide some historical context on presidents and their nominees to the Supreme Court.
Well, George Washington got to pick, I believe, the first six justices, but he was actually dwarfed by Franklin Roosevelt, who I believe got to pick 10 justices in 13 years. So if you were able to keep winning elections, which you used to be able to do before the 22nd Amendment was passed, you can actually pick more than George Washington. And FDR, I think by the end of his 13 years in office, he didn't know where to find more justices. He was running out of ideas.
Now, has the process of selection been as political and partisan as it has been really since the Robert Bork hearings several years ago?
Well, I guess the long answer is yes. The politics of this process have always been there from the very beginning when George Washington's choice for Chief Justice, John Jay, was rejected for Chief Justice by the Senate. And it continues up, obviously, through this day. I think what's changed is the nature of the process in terms of public participation. It was always political, but the politics was very inside the beltway. There wasn't much of a beltway back then, but it was insider politics. It was maneuvering at the highest levels. We didn't have confirmation hearings. We didn't really even get to meet these justices, see them. In fact, the nominees themselves didn't even show up to any hearings of any kind until the 20th century. So the nature of it has changed, but it's always been political.
How political was it back in the 18th and 19th centuries in the sense of who was being selected and why they were being selected? Because we didn't have as many law schools. We didn't have as many courts. The court system was slightly different than it is today. It didn't mature. What's been the development of it?
Well, I think you hit on it. Obviously, the whole modern system of law schools didn't even evolve into something that's remotely near what we have today till the end of the 19th century. Many people didn't even attend law school before they became lawyers. They would do apprenticeships. So the whole notion of being from Harvard or Yale Law School was relatively meaningless. And your point about the courts is well taken. Today, there's almost this unwritten norm that you have to have some judicial experience. And Elena Kagan has to overcome that right now. It was the opposite, I think. Back in the early part of the 19th and 18th centuries, justices came from the cabinet. They came from the Senate or the House. They came from almost everywhere in life but the bench. And so that's changed as well.
Well, let's fast forward to that point in time when Robert Bork went in front of the Senate confirmation process, and his legal history on paper became the issue. And from that point forward, it seems, that's been where the critics have risen and the divide on both sides of the aisle has really come. Was that the first time that previous writings by a judge or a appellate court jurist or a professor of law became the issue to rally around?
Well, it's interesting. It wasn't so much his writings, obviously, as a judge. There have been issues about prior judges, but very often those kinds of decisions were not the kinds of decisions that got somebody into trouble. And in the case of Bork, his record on the D.C. Court of Appeals for 4 or 5 years was actually somewhat moderate. The American Bar Association, which opposed him, basically, by calling him only qualified for the position, not highly qualified, even they admitted that there was a moderate tone and hardly extremist. The problem for Bork was in the academic writings, what he wrote as a professor at Yale Law School. That's where he got himself into trouble, taking provocative positions. I'm a professor, and I can tell you, nobody's going to publish anything if you there is no such thing as the Journal of Null Hypotheses and Null Results. You have to say something that provokes. You have to say something that goes up against the conventional wisdom of the mainstream, or nobody even hears you. But that's exactly the kind of thing that can get you into big trouble if you're trying to get on the Supreme Court. Elena Kagan right now didn't write nearly as provocative things as Bork did, but one article that she did write in 1995 about confirmation hearings, that's probably going to come back, and we're going to see that in the next month or so.
Well, Bork also had his connection to the Watergate situation, as he was the guy that actually did the firing.
Well, they didn't want him to do the firing. The story of the Saturday Night Massacre is that Nixon wanted the special prosecutor fired. He wasn't an independent prosecutor, so he could legally be fired. Nixon asked his attorney general, Elliot Richardson, to do it. Richardson refused. Nixon fired Elliot Richardson, then went to the deputy attorney general, Ruckelshaus. Will you fire him? He refused. He was fired. Bork was third in line as the solicitor general and now in charge of the Justice Department because of everybody else being fired. And so when it was actually Richardson, the fired attorney general, who went to Bork and said, look, I know you're opposed to this, too. Fire him. We don't want the janitor firing the special prosecutor. And so, you know, Bork gets a bad rap for that. And the truth is, I think to some extent Republicans and the Reagan administration were bracing for a big Saturday Night Massacre fight. You know what? It didn't happen. They focused on other things. He wasn't punished for that.
Let's fast forward now to today. Obviously, this nomination of Elena Kagan by President Barack Obama is his second, really within about a year of his inauguration. Of course, the Sonia Sotomayor confirmation hearings last year. It's quite likely, given the age of some of the sitting justices and the possibility of a second Obama term, he's going to get more than two. The average seems to have been about four in the 20th century, from what I can see looking at the list of justices and the presidents, other than, of course, you mentioned Roosevelt.
Roosevelt screws up the average because the last few presidents have only had two each, including Clinton and Bush, both of whom had 8 years, and they only got two each. So Roosevelt screws up all the averages, Ken.
So we know that they come in, and the presidents come in with a list of potential candidates. Looking at the long perspective, the connections between presidents and justices, is there any pattern that's discernible as to where they actually come from? Is it someone completely out of left field, or is it someone who they've actually known, as seems to be the case now?
There are patterns, and it almost seems like the breaking point is 1968. Prior to 1968, I think there was, you know, Washington was a relatively small place. Quite frankly, political aristocracy was a pretty small group, and most people did know most people. And certainly Lyndon Johnson knew very well his nominees. John Kennedy knew very well Arthur Goldberg and Byron White. They both worked for him. FDR knew all of his nominees very well. So I think the world prior to 1968 was, if you want to get on the Supreme Court, meet a governor or senator who will one day be president and stay friends with him, play poker with him. After 1968, that kind of changed. There was a big hubbub over Abe Fortas's nomination as Chief Justice. There was a sense that he was too close to Lyndon Johnson. And really, since then, presidents have looked mostly to the Court of Appeals, and generally, career jurists are not the kind of people who the presidents know very well. Barack Obama is in some sense marking a potential return to the days of yore. He knew Sonia Sotomayor a little bit. Elena Kagan, he knows quite a bit, his own solicitor general. They have a background back at the University of Chicago Law School. So we might actually be marking here, Ken, a return to a time where justices and presidents did know each other much better.
We spoke earlier of the law school connections with, of course, looking to law schools. Kagan is dean, former dean of Harvard. You look at the makeup of the court, almost everyone is from an Ivy League school. There are some who would have issues with that you're just going to the same sources. Is it good that we have justices coming from that type of background, or is it better that they more represent the population of the country?
You know, it's fascinating, Ken. if Elena Kagan's confirmed, we're certainly going to have a very diverse bench in terms of gender and ethnicity. We'll have an African-American justice, a Latin American justice, and three women justices. So from that standpoint, looking quite diverse. But you've hit on another way in which the court has become more homogeneous. If Kagan is accepted, we will have six Catholics and three Jews. No Protestants on the court. Homogeneity, but not exactly in the majority's direction. Then you look at law schools. You know, just 25 years ago, Warren Berger went to the St. Paul College of Law, Stevens Northwestern. So you did have a little bit of a mix. Hugo Black, 30 years ago, from the University of Alabama. Now it's all Harvard and Yale. And it is amazing the degree to even the Stanford people are now gone. So I think you've hit on it. The pedigree is becoming similar, although the bench looks to be more diverse outside.
When you wrote your book, which is now almost a decade ago that it was published, you had access to presidential papers from presidential libraries. You had access to the actual players in the more recent administrations. And you projected in the epilogue a little bit of, you know, what are we going to learn once the current crop of papers are available, those being from Clinton and the first Bush presidency, George Herbert Walker Bush. My question is to you, are those papers becoming available? Are you still pursuing the inside story of how these selections were made? And if so, have you had a chance to look at any yet?
I have had a chance to look at the George H.W. Bush papers, and there is a little bit there, particularly this whole question of the degree to which Souter and his relatively moderate, some would even say moderate to liberal, ideology was something that was not known.
And we're talking about David Souter, who's just retired and who really was a surprise after John Sununu.
Well, it was a surprise to some people. Right. I mean, I think to some extent, even John Sununu, when he was recommending that individual, they had New Hampshire ties to his boss, George H.W. Bush. I think even Sununu recognized that this was a wild card. And I saw some correspondence where he was being hopeful that he was going to be where they wanted him to be, which is very different from the reassurances and the confidence that you normally get in that kind of circumstance. The Bill Clinton library is working very, very slowly by the Presidential Records Act. There's a very long queue. And no one anticipates there's going to be very much of substance there on this issue because Bill Clinton used to like to work in conversation. There weren't a lot of very formal memos going back and forth on this kind of thing. So as with the Kennedy administration, where we really didn't have that much except for oral conversations, I think that's the same thing with Bill Clinton. I should let you know, though, all of us researchers have been in a bind since 9/11. The President George W. Bush, who was president when 9/11 happened, put down a executive order severely limiting the ability to look at presidential papers, and that applied to all papers, not just his own, obviously. So we've all been working under different circumstances. I guess I got that book published in 99 in the nick of time.
I guess the way to wrap things up is looking towards the future. Again, President Obama may have more nominations to go. Has the process been so set down now in partisanship that it won't change very much, or is there still hope that we could have a more user-friendly process for the advice and consent role of the Senate?
Well, we have an interesting test coming up right now, and this might be the moment where if there's going to be change, it'll take place. You have a Lady Kagan who most people concede is relatively non-controversial. You have a very, very strong Democratic majority. It's not 60, but 59 is pretty darn good by historical standards. You add all that up, and you have a nominee who might simply be confident enough, not arrogant, but confident enough to be able to talk a little more open and provide a little more candor about her positions on general issues. You're never going to get a nominee to tell us exactly what we want. Here's how I would vote on this case. But Elena Kagan wrote at length about the importance of nominees coming clean about where they stand and about their philosophy in as specific a way as possible. So this really truly might be the hope. And I'll tell you, Ken, if we don't get much candor or genuine open frankness from Elena Kagan, I'm not sure we're ever going to get it from anybody.
Okay, Professor David Yaloff, talking about Supreme Court justice nominations and the process. Thanks very much.
Thanks, Ken, for having me.